They don't do it to be trendy. For generations in Bulgaria, they adopt a vegetarian diet for 40 days before they pork out on Christmas Day.
No meat at the table, no dairy products, no eggs, only vegan.
Coming up, we'll learn about the intricate customs for the holidays that you find only in Bulgaria. Not far away, Istanbul is spiffing up with a new airport, art museum, and waterfront stroll at its new cruise ship terminal.
Just a beautiful promenade to enjoy the Bosphorus, the iconic view of historical Istanbul, lots of restaurants, lots of little boutiques and shops.
Plus, we'll dive deep into our home pantries to find ingredients from all around the world that spice up our American palate.
We can travel the world when it comes to food and culture without ever leaving the boundaries of our country.
Come celebrate with us in the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. In most of Europe, the Christmas season lasts for exactly 1 month. Things gear up around St. Nicholas Day on December 6th and wind up with the wise men and the Feast of Epiphany just after New Year's. Today on Travel with Rick Steves, we'll warm up to the holidays as Stefan Bozajev explains the unique old world customs they observe in Bulgaria and what they represent. That's in just a minute. Not far from Bulgaria, the residents of Istanbul are excited about a number of improvements to their powerhouse city. Turkish tour guide Lali Sermon Aran tells us what's new in a bit. And culinary historian Sarah Lohman brings us the untold story of American cuisine. It's found in 8 ingredients that you probably have in your spice rack or kitchen pantry. 8 essential flavors from around the world that unite our palates all across North America. Let's start the hour with a Bulgarian-style Christmas, and Stefan Bozajev's our guide.
Thank you for having me, Rick. Yes, now we are getting ready for Christmas. What is really important for us is the Christmas Eve day. We prepare very special meals, and all of them, they have to be vegan. No meat at the table, no dairy products, no eggs, only vegan. And the number of meals is also very special. They should be odd number. Otherwise, we are not allowed to eat.
Now, wait a minute. And this is new for me. Odd number of people at the table, you mean? Like 3 or 5?
Odd number of meals on the table. Like different dishes.
Dishes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then vegan, is that something that's a modern health thing or is that a traditional thing?
Actually, having a vegan meal is very old. It is the way how we celebrate the traditions because it is the end of the Christmas fast. And for us, fasting equals being vegan for 40 days.
So you fast before Christmas? I thought you fast before Easter.
So we fast before Christmas, we fast before Easter, we fast before the Assumption of Virgin Mary. We fast a lot.
It's a fast society. My goodness. Okay, so you've been fasting, and then you come out of the fast, and you're going to have vegan food and a big celebration.
Exactly. And before starting eating, of course, there should be a prayer said and incense lit. Having incense means that we will chase all the evil spirits away from this home, away from this neighborhood, away from this town.
Now, this is the Orthodox Christian tradition, and I met an Orthodox priest who was very interested in introducing me to the incense. It was like there's 2 kinds of people in the world, those who understand incense and those who don't understand incense. Do you understand incense?
I was born with a deep understanding and appreciation of incense. It's in my heart.
Tell us about it, because it's something that the typical American, whether they go to church or not, we don't get incense.
Definitely, when you go to an Eastern Orthodox church, you will smell something bizarre, and that's the smell of incense. Actually, it is believed that it helps of chasing those evil spirits away. It's the home of God. And incense just helps. And then at the same time, when we have the different celebrations at home, and especially talking about Christmas Eve, the presence of incense is vital. The meaning of it is, let us be healthy. Let us keep the evil away. That's why we have this smell.
This beautiful priest that I was talking with in an Eastern Orthodox church, he pulled out a box of incense, and it was like a painter's collection of different colors of paint for his palette. And it was like he was painting the atmosphere with the incense. And depending on the feeling he wanted to create, he would pull different bits of incense out of this box. And he knew what he was designing. He was an interior designer. He was a painter. He was a master at setting the table so we would have the proper sensual experience. Is that something that characterizes an Orthodox church, maybe compared to a Protestant church?
Absolutely. This will be something that would make a distinction. This is something that we would have deep into the roots of Eastern Orthodox. This is something that whenever you enter our churches, regardless it's a large cathedral or a tiny church in the countryside, this is something that you'll find in common, repeating, because this is something vital and this is something that is part of our traditions.
We're talking with Stefan Bozjev of Bulgaria. It's Christmas time. And Stefan, you've been celebrating Christmas for a lifetime in Bulgaria. Tell us the way the event plays out on Christmas Eve and then Christmas Day. Where do you go? What do you do? Who are you with?
Well, definitely it's a family celebration. It's a family thing. We get together. We enjoy love. We enjoy food. And then when it's midnight, we're waiting for guests to come. And these guests are the young boys from the neighborhood. They would come and sing carols and give us blessings. And then, on the next day, most typically, we'll be ready for another tradition. All of those families in the countryside who have their pigs, it is the time to turn the pig into something else, to turn it into food. And don't get me wrong, Rick. This is something that is very traditional. This is something that would preserve us as different people from our neighbors, for example.
So you slaughter the pig and have a festival?
We slaughter the pig and have a festival. And we have all of our friends and relatives and neighbors coming up. And then typically a quarter of the pig will be prepared and eaten on the spot, because you have to feed all those people who came to help you with this task.
And what would be on the table? What would you be eating for that great Christmas feast?
Well, definitely it will be pork. Pork is the traditional meat that we will have for Easter. And quite often it would come with pickled cabbage and also different pickles for starter, because it's hard to find fresh salads. So we have pickles, of course, with rakia. And then we go to the pork.
We go to the pork. When you think way back to your early childhood, what are your first memories? What are your most beautiful memories of Christmas?
Well, snow. A lot of snow going into my village and slaughtering the pig.
There's a lot of different cultures, different societies that celebrate Christmas on different days. Sometimes it starts early with St. Nicholas or Santa Lucia. Sometimes it's Christmas Eve. Sometimes it's Christmas Day. Sometimes it's Epiphany on January 6th. What are the big days in the Bulgarian calendar for the Christmas season?
Definitely it will be St. Nicholas Day. It is mandatory to have fish on the table. Most typically it will be stuffed carp. And then, of course, we come to December 24th, when it is the Christmas Eve, and then the big day, December 25th, when it is Christmas. And practically the cycle is finished with the Epiphany Day, when we have another tradition. I mean the priest. The Orthodox priest will throw the cross into the freezing waters of a lake, of a river, and young men will jump to rescue the cross. The one who would be the first one would be blessed with health and happiness throughout the year. And that's on Epiphany.
Sounds like it's a busy time for the Orthodox priest.
It is very busy time, but it is busy for everyone. But in the end of the day, traditions, these are just traditions. And even if they keep us busy, we love them and we respect them.
We're learning about the importance of Christmas season traditions in Bulgaria from one of that country's most knowledgeable tour guides, Stefan Bozajev. He guides with Luba Tours, named in memory of the woman who first introduced us to Bulgarian holiday traditions back in 2010 on Travel with Rick Steves. He posts photos on Facebook at Down the Road with Stefan, and that's Stefan with an F. How about the gifts? Are gifts a big part of Christmas from the perspective of a small child in Bulgaria, opening up the presents, Santa Claus, and that sort of thing?
It is very important, but years ago, it was not the Christmas day. It was on the New Year's Day, back in the communist time, when Christmas was seen as a religious holiday. This is why the communists wanted to have another holiday, and that was New Year's Day. And then we didn't have Santa Claus. We had Dyadu Mraz, or Grandpa Cold. That was the name in Bulgarian language. That was the person to bring gifts to the kids. And now, today, there are families that celebrate both of the days with presents, not only for the children. We are all little children deep into our hearts.
So that's interesting, because you had the communist time, and which was anti-church and atheistic, and they wanted to take that energy but translate it from a holy day to more of just a festival day, New Year's Day. And Grandpa Cold, would that be like we have the Father Frost?
Definitely, that's our equivalent.
Father Frost, yeah.
Father Frost, exactly.
But then when you got freedom, there was an appetite to take the focus back to December 25. You were free to do that when the communists were gone.
Absolutely. And now in more families, this will be actually the day celebrated with presents under the Christmas tree.
And when you look back at this Christmas, what will you remember as the highlight for you and your loved ones?
Probably it was the fact that we were together with my loved ones. We had food on our table. We had roofs above our heads. And we enjoyed it in peace, because there are people who are not able to do that these days.
Stefan Bozajev, thank you so much for sharing with us a fascinating look at a different Christmas tradition. And I hope you have a beautiful Bulgarian Christmas time with you and your family. And I hope you also have a Happy New Year. How do you say Merry Christmas and Happy New Year in Bulgaria?
Vesela Koleda i Čestita Nova Godina.
Merry Christmas, Stefan. Thank you.
Vesela Koleda, Rick. Благодаря.
Благодаря. We provide links to Stefan Bozajev and all of today's guests in this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see how many of the 8 essential spices you might have in your kitchen as Sarah Lohman looks at the basic flavors we all tend to enjoy. But first, let's hear what's new in Istanbul on Travel with Rick Steves. Istanbul is one of the world's great cities, period. Along with Paris, London, and Rome, it's one of the 4 European cities that I think is worth an entire 1-week vacation. While visiting the ancient sites and absorbing its history is a must, there's a modern and ever-changing Istanbul that's really worth exploring as well. We're joined now by my favorite Turkish guide, Lali Sermon Aran, to get an update on this megapolis of over 15 million people that bridges Asia and Europe. Lali, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting, Rick. Merhaba.
Merhaba. You know, every time I fly to Istanbul, not many cities do I make a point to look out the window. But when I fly into Istanbul, I'm just enchanted by the sprawling nature of the city and the floodlit mosques and the beautiful waterways. What do you see when you fly home and your plane is coming into Istanbul and you look out the window? What do you see?
I look for Bosphorus. It is like a turquoise necklace on the neck of a beautiful woman.
Oh my goodness. The Bosphorus is the strait of water that divides Asia and Europe.
Or the strait that connects the Black Sea and the Mediterranean.
That's right. Now, let's set the table here historically by telling us about the foundations of Istanbul. Can you brag just for a minute about the importance of the city back in ancient Roman times, 1700 years ago?
Of course. It was the capital city of Roman Empire after Constantine moved the capital from Rome. He didn't call it Constantinople. He called it the New Rome. The city was called Constantinople after Constantine was gone. So that is where he chose to rule his empire because it was more centrally located.
And it was a little more stable, I would think, than the
chaos where Rome was.
So basically, Rome was falling in the 300s. The emperor decided, heck, I'm getting out of here. And he settled in what he called the New Rome.
Yes.
And it became to be called Constantinople after him, Emperor Constantine.
Yes.
So that's the ancient city. It was very important. It was important as a Byzantine empire. And
then
when you say Byzantine, the western half of Rome fell. The eastern half survived it, ruled from Constantinople. And then it sort of morphed over time to become the Byzantine Empire. Is that right?
Exactly. That is right.
Okay. So you have that Christian heritage of the Roman Empire.
Yes.
Which the last 200s were Christian.
Yes.
And then it survived centuries and centuries after that until the Muslims came.
Yes.
Consequently, in Istanbul, which we think of as so Muslim, has some of the greatest Christian art anywhere in Christendom.
Exactly. The Muslims came in the mid-15th century, but the Greek Orthodox head of the church, the Patriarch, always stayed in Istanbul, did not go anywhere.
So this is fascinating to me. The religious leader of 300 million Greek Orthodox Christians
lives in Istanbul.
Lives not in Greece, but in Istanbul, in Turkey. How does that work?
Good.
He's just doing fine there. He doesn't need to move to Greece.
I mean, among the Turks, at least, there is not a discussion about if he should leave or stay.
Yeah.
We're good with it.
And what's interesting to me is today, and a lot of people don't appreciate this, but there must be hundreds of millions of Turkic people, and Istanbul is way on the west end of this demographic swath that sweeps across Eurasia. And Istanbul is a very, very important cultural pinnacle of all of these Turkic people. What would some of these countries be?
Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan.
So they look to Istanbul for some kind of cultural leadership?
Exactly. They look up to Istanbul. They look up to Turkey. It's their ideal of living. And it's not only for the people who live in the former USSR satellite states, but also people in the Middle East and in the Gulf countries look up to Turkey, look up to life in Istanbul.
And also, Turkey is a relatively modern, pluralistic, Muslim society that can set a standard where a lot of Muslim societies that don't have that separation of mosque and state can aspire to.
True. You can be a very pious Muslim and can spend your days praying in a mosque, cover from top to toe, or you can be a liberal woman, dress as independently as you like, and enjoy all the benefits of the modern life. Nobody would criticize this or the other.
And I think from a lot of people's point of view, that Turkey, that pluralistic Turkey, is just as Muslim as Pakistan or Iran or whatever you
exactly.
Like.
Exactly.
Yeah. Lali Sermon Aran takes your calls about Istanbul in a moment at 877-333-7425. Lali and her husband, Tan, provide custom tours in Turkey and neighboring countries through their company, SRM Travel. Their website is srmtravel.com. Tan and Lali are also the co-authors of the Rick Steves Istanbul Guidebook. There's a lot going on in Istanbul culturally, and today it's a city of over 15 million people, and it is thriving. And what I'd like to do, Lali, is spend a few minutes talking about what's new.
Okay.
And what I've always thought is the Bosphorus is the big deal. You know, that's the, as you said, the waterway that connects the Black Sea with the Mediterranean. It's the waterway that divides where Europe and Asia meet. But I think the Golden Horn might be underrated.
It's not a bit underrated. It's hugely underrated because if there was no Golden Horn, there would not be any Istanbul, period.
Why is that?
Period. Because Bosphorus, with the Dardanelles in southwest, are the busiest waterways of the entire world. But what I like to point out is that there was an ancient city by Dardanelles, Troy.
Okay.
And Troy is lost in history.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Istanbul, Constantinople, didn't because of the Golden Horn. Golden Horn is a 4.2-mile-long inlet that provided a safe area for shipyards, docks where the goods can be stored, loaded, and unloaded. So if the city has lasted all these centuries, It is because golden horn.
And it is, they call it a horn. It's looked like it's a horn that gouged into the land from the Bosporus. Today we've got the wonderful Galata Bridge that people can walk across and fish and have a meal.
Yes.
And that's at the mouth of the Golden Horn. And what I was very thankful for is the tram line now that goes all the way up the Golden Horn. And how I remember 10 years ago you told me, Rick, this looks like a very neglected part of the city right now, but our government, our city government, has a vision to turn this into a park, a people's zone. And I thought, that's going to be a big job. Good luck. And It's here. It's happened.
There's a tram line all along the Golden Horn. There are beautiful parks for leisure that the people enjoy. And the existence of the new tram line makes it so easy to see different sites along the Golden Horn if you don't want to walk.
I love it. Lolly, when we're thinking about Istanbul, anything these days, there's so many great sites that are open and closed and getting restored and everything. And in Istanbul, the big news was the precious Korva Church was closed. It is the church with the most sumptuous Byzantine, I mean, really early Christian mosaics. And for a lot of people, they go to Istanbul to see the Korva Church. What's the status on the Korva Church?
The status technically is a mosque. But the narthex and the paraclesia, the burial chamber, are what we would call the museum of the church. And you need to get a ticket to enter there. The narthexes are full of gorgeous golden mosaics.
Okay, so this 1,500-year-old church has been for centuries a mosque, and now it is still a mosque, but the most beautiful Christian art is opened in a museum part of the
exactly.
mosque.
Exactly. Only the very, very center is used as a mosque, not where the mosaics and the frescoes.
I see. And tell us, why are these mosaics so important?
Well, you can associate every culture with a different form of art, and when talking about Byzantine art, the only thing that comes into my mind automatically is the mosaics. They excelled the art of mosaics. They took it from the ground, put it on the walls, and put it on the ceiling.
Ah, the Romans had a lot of pavement mosaics.
Exactly, exactly.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about what's going on in Istanbul, and our guide is Lolly Sermon Aran. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Lynn's on the line from Tamarack in Florida. Lynn, thanks for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, I had just taken a course on Byzantine art, architecture, and history, and the professor mentioned Hagia Sophia, of course, and she said it started off as a church, then it became a mosque due to the history, then a museum, and it's back to a mosque again, but she wasn't sure if they were protecting the mosaics and if they were available to be seen, because she did mention how in the past they got covered up when it was a mosque. So how convenient that I can ask you this question, because she didn't know the answer.
Well, Lolly would certainly know, and I want to make clear about the church mosque we're talking about. It's different spellings for different languages. A lot of people see Hagia Sophia or Hagia Sophia, and it is probably the most important historic building to see in the city. You'll certainly be there. And Lolly, get us up to date on the preciousness of the mosaics and what's visible.
Merhaba, thank you for your call. Hagia Sophia at the moment is a functioning mosque, but the upper gallery is a museum where the mosaics are. They're not covered up, they're protected. So the visitors can go to the upper gallery, see the mosaics, and have a great view of the lower gallery from the balconies.
And those mosaics are precious.
They're very gorgeous.
They're from a church that goes back how many centuries? From what century are those mosaics?
6th century.
And we have to remember, when a different religion comes in, it's just common sense. I mean, from a cultural and a religious point of view, you cover up the art of the previous religion and you put your art on top of it.
Yes. And when they were covered up, they were not covered up with Muslim art. They were just covered with a plaster.
Okay.
So it was easier to clean the plaster in 1930s when it was decided to be made into a museum.
It's just some sumptuous art. And of course, the Muslim art is beautiful as well. And
different.
I'm always reminded, very different, because of course the Muslim sensibility is not to show images. So you'd have Muhammad and you'd have Allah in calligraphy, but never a statue or a painting.
Exactly.
All right. Lynn, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Carol's calling in, also from Florida, from Bel Air, Florida. Carol, thanks.
I have a question. I'm planning on going to Istanbul within the next year. Is it safe for a single woman to travel through Turkey?
Merhaba.
Merhaba.
Turkey is very safe for a single woman to travel. We have very minimum street crime. You would not feel threatened. You would not feel fear. The only thing that you might feel different are the hawkers in the old town who are trying to sell you stuff. That would be the only danger you have, spending more money than you plan.
There are some pretty aggressive salespeople, and they know who's got money, who's overwhelmed, who's sweet, who's a good victim, you know. And in a victim, I'm saying in kind of a fun way, because it's just they just want you to buy some of their stuff.
That's it. Nothing else.
It's a reasonable question, but once you've been to Turkey, you realize it's about as dangerous as Paris or Madrid or, well, not as dangerous as New York, you see. So, you know, if you're good in a big city, you can do fine in Istanbul.
Is there a better area? I'm not talking safety-wise, but I'm talking about a better area of the city to be able to see things?
Yes, there is. For many years, we hosted our groups in the heart of the old town because that's where the museums and the monuments are. But the old town is so much touristy now, once the museum hours are done, it's only other tourists on the streets.
And this is in the shadow of the Blue Mosque in the
Hippodrome
exactly.
area. Yeah. It is still beautiful. It's lit beautifully, but there is no local life.
Right.
And to understand and experience the city better, I suggest a location which sits at the intersection of the old town, the new town, Golden Horn, and Bosphorus. So this is just like a junction that's connecting all of it. The neighborhood is Karaköy, K-A-R-A-K-O-Y.
Karaköy.
You can walk to the new town. You can walk to the old town. There's a tram going by it.
It's got this wonderful tram.
Yes, exactly. And that's the area.
Tell us about the practicality of the tram for visitors like Carol.
In Istanbul, all you need to be close to the tram line 1. It connects almost all tourist sites to one another. And if that is the only public transport you get to learn about and use, that will be enough for you. So Karaköy is right on that line.
All right. And is this Karaköy neighborhood, that is also near the new port, the Galata port?
The Galata port is in Karaköy.
Okay, that's right.
It's a beautiful promenade.
So several massive cruise ships can tie up at the same time.
Yes, it's very modern.
Yeah.
And the cruise terminal is dug under the ground. So there's nothing above the ground, but just a beautiful promenade to enjoy the Bosphorus, the iconic view of historical Istanbul. Lots of restaurants, lots of little boutiques and shops.
And
Very lively.
It is a blessing for people on a cruise ship because all you do is walk off the cruise ship and you go a couple of blocks inland. And one block inland and you hop on the tram.
Yes, yes. And that's what I recommend.
Really nice.
Hey, Carol, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Lali Aran is our guide to what's new in Istanbul right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She has more on her website, laliaran.com. That's LALEARAN. Another new bit of sightseeing in town is nearby the Galata port, the cruise port that we were just talking about, which is so cutting edge and such a big news for tourism in Istanbul, and it's the Modern Art Museum.
It's called the Istanbul Modern. Yes, it sits at the center of the cruise port, and it exhibits examples from figurative Turkish art from 19th and 20th centuries.
Now, is this something that is, I got to be honest, I've been to art galleries in Istanbul where it's like they haven't dusted since the 1970s, you know. Is this one an old school art gallery or does
not.
It feel it, sparkly like it could be in New York?
It is. It can be in New York. It can be in Spain. It can be in London.
Nice.
It is our version of Tate Modern.
Oh, there you go. And what is the name again?
Istanbul Modern.
Istanbul Modern. So if we want to get a slice of today's artistic
That's the destination to go.
That's the place to go. Another big dimension to me as a traveler of Istanbul is to recognize that a lot of Istanbul is on the Asian side. It's a 15-minute ride or so on a ferry across the Bosphorus. I don't think it has any earth-shaking sites in particular. Of course, it has
Not sites. Historical sites.
Yeah, because that's all going to be in the places we've been
exactly.
talking about. But it is thriving. And if you just want a slice of life, Istanbul, What a delight. What would you recommend for a traveler visiting Istanbul when it comes to Asia?
I would definitely, even people come for a single day, I suggest them that they take a ferry across the Bosphorus from Karaköy to Üsküdar. It's, as you said, less than 15 minutes. And then you will be at the center of the local life. You will see the locals coming and going from their work, commuting between Europe and Asia.
How many people commute between Asia and Europe in one day, would you say?
Using the ferries, about 3 million people.
And then a lot of people would take the subway also underneath the water.
Yes, and close to 1 million people take the subway.
So it'd be very easy to go from essentially the Golden Horn across to the Asian city and then stroll along the harbor front. And you can choose any number of restaurants and eat with Turkish people that are out doing the same thing. And you look across the harbor and you see the Mosque of Suleiman the Magnificent.
Or the Blue Mosque.
Or the Blue Mosque.
Hagia Sophia.
Or the Topkapi Palace.
Exactly.
Lolly, we're out of time. It's been wonderful talking with you about what's new in Istanbul. And Lolly, what's old in Istanbul is the beauty of going to a tea house and just having a glass of tea. Can you take me in our imaginations to a wonderful tea house and describe the experience you would share with me as we get intimate with the slice of life of Turkey you can have in a tea house?
We're walking along the Bosphorus. We are hearing the ferries that pass by, but we're also hearing little clinking sounds, like when you hit the glass with a fork or a spoon, a tiny one, clink, 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 clink. That's the tea house. We approach to the tea house, take our seats, overlooking the Bosphorus, offer our teas that are served in what we call tulip glasses, little tulip-shaped glasses, and just sip them peacefully watching the view.
I love that. Lolly, thanks so much. And I look forward to seeing you again in your beautiful city, Istanbul.
Hoşça kal.
Lolly tells us more about Istanbul's nightlife and its big new airport in an extra at ricksteves.com/radio. Find out what the 8 flavors are that help define American cuisine next on Travel with Rick Steves. How would you describe typical American foods? Or rather, what flavors come to mind when you say American cuisine? Sarah Lohman argues there are 8 flavors that unite the American food landscape. And like any good culinary historian worth their salt, she uses food to explore what our past can tell us about the present. Sarah writes that the United States boasts a culturally and ethnically diverse population that makes for a continually changing culinary landscape. And American food is united by these 8 flavors. Get ready now. Black pepper, vanilla, curry powder, chili powder, soy sauce, garlic, MSG, and sriracha. In her book, 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine, she explores how these influential ingredients made their way to the American table. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hello, it's so good to be here.
Yeah, and it's so good to explore food, which we all love or can't live without, with somebody who really knows what they're talking about. So first of all, American cuisine. I mean, you know, we're such a melting pot.
Yes.
How can you describe American cuisine? What is it?
I think that is really what drove me to write this book, because we are such a diverse nation, both because of our own individual ancestries, but also our geography, too, really affects what we're eating and what it tastes like. So I thought to myself, okay, but let's look at something like black pepper or vanilla. Why do you keep seeing that appear in everybody's pantry, whether their ancestors are English and they live in Maine, or whether their ancestors are from Mexico and they live in Southern California, right? So that's the question I wanted to answer.
All right. And when we think about these flavors, each one has a story. And that's the cool thing about your book, just taking each one of these fundamental flavors and telling its story, where it came from, who are the people behind that, what is the geographical reason for it, and how is it embraced today? So once again, we're going to look at black pepper, vanilla, curry powder, chili powder, soy sauce, garlic, MSG, and sriracha. And we'll see how far we get on this. But black pepper, it's so basic, so fundamental. How did that become part of our national cuisine?
Yeah, that was exactly the question that I wanted to answer, because it's so common we don't think about it. Where is it?
Right.
What is it from? And it turns out that it was really sort of a post-Revolutionary War explosion of American commerce. That pre-Revolutionary War, we had to buy everything through England. And that is part of what, I mean, that's why we were dumping tea in the harbor. We were basically protesting that we had to buy from England and pay their taxes. So it was through England we were getting black pepper, and they were keeping secret where they were getting it from. And then finally, it sort of leaked that black pepper came from Sumatra on the other side of the planet. And it was some really sort of brave and also, you know, again, capitalist people who wanted to make money, merchants out of Salem, Massachusetts, that launched the first boats to go to the other side of the world. And America ended up taking away the black pepper trade from England, honestly, because we were nice to the native peoples of Sumatra, paid a fair wage, weren't violent, treated them as equals. And then everyone said, well, we want to trade with the Americans, not with the British. And so there were millionaires made in the late 18th century on the black pepper trade in Massachusetts.
Because, you know, right now I happen to be out of pepper in my house.
Ah.
And I'm realizing, I mean, it's just very, it's kind of a crisis. I got to go shopping just for this pepper.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so necessary, but I think it's so kind of underappreciated. And it's fascinating to think that we actually went on treacherous, you know, very costly voyages to get away from that British middleman and be have control of our own source of pepper.
Yeah, it's not a native plant. So we went a very, very long way to get it.
All right, let's talk about vanilla.
Okay, so actually speaking of, vanilla is a native plant. It comes from Central America, and sort of the best known vanilla growing regions are right along the Gulf Coast in the region of Pampantla in Mexico. So vanilla really relied on native pollinators, and people were smuggling it out of Mexico and planting it all around the equator. The plant would bloom. It's an orchid, but it wouldn't produce the vanilla bean, the fruit of that orchid, until there was a plant in Réunion that, all right, so this was a enslaved island, a French colony. There was an enslaver who had a young slave, a boy who was named Edmond Albias. So there is an enslaver on Réunion. He had an enslaved boy named Edmond Albias, but he really educated this young boy, especially in botany. And it's Edward Albias that figured out how to hand pollinate a vanilla orchid. And it is still the same method of pollination that's used around the planet today. So a really remarkable innovation by a young black man.
What a story.
Yeah.
Just a teeny bopper black slave boy innovated something that had an impact that we're feeling today on something so fundamental to our cuisine.
Yes. And of course, you know, the sad end to that story is that he really never saw a dime from it. He was given his freedom, and the man who was his former master really advocated we should set up, you know, a monthly income for this guy. Like, he made us all rich. And everyone just said, nah, we're not going to do that. So at least now we are starting to remember his name and his incredible contribution to our
Edmond
food.
Albias.
Edmond
Next
Albias.
Next time you have a vanilla ice cream, Edmond Albias.
Think of him, definitely.
And we can toast to him with our ice cream cone.
Yes.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're joined by culinary historian Sarah Lohman. She's compiled a history of 8 key ingredients to American cuisine in her book. It's called 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Her latest book is Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. You can find out more about Sarah's work at her website. It's sarahlohman.com, L-O-H-M-A-N. Well, this is just so interesting. Let's just carry on. Curry powder. I mean, that's something that it'd be hard to manage without. Where did it come from and what's its story? And it's really cool when there's a person involved
yes.
in the actual story of these foods.
You know, and that's such an interesting one to me because we have American curry recipes from the 18th century, even before in one of the British cookbooks that was really common in early America. There's curry recipes in there. But if I'm going through that list of American flavors, that's the one where people would stop me and say, wait a minute, that's not American. Well, we've been making it for 300 years, so what does that say about our perception of what's American or not? Huh. And in that chapter, I really focus on a chef. His name was Ranjit Smile, or that was one of his names, I should say. We don't really know what his real name was. And at other points, he went by Joe, or he even went by Prince at one point, too. He really was quite a character. He was an immigrant from modern-day Pakistan via London to New York City in 1899. He cooked at one of the finest restaurants in New York City and cooked an Indian menu, as it was called. And he eventually became this like touring chef celebrity that would cook these Indian meals all across the East Coast. But also, he was kind of a bad boy, and he was married at least 5 times. And so he would, like, news about him. I found it in articles as far west as, like, Iowa and Utah. So he really was this known name that now has been really largely erased. And he was really key to the introduction of really traditional Indian food to America.
And when was that, roughly what year?
He lived in America between 1899 and 1930. And in 1930, he got on a boat saying that he was going to go home. And that is the last we've heard of him. Not just me, but other scholars are continuing to dig to find out what the end of his story is. But he really dominated the early 20th century in America.
So we have curry powder, and then we have chili powder.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story with chili powder? And also, a lot of this seems to might relate to pre-refrigeration days. I mean, you know, I think I get a sense that a lot of spices, we like them because they're spicy. But a long time ago, you had to eat a lot of food that was borderline and you wanted to mask the sourness or the staleness of it by spicing it up.
Oh, Rick, I'm so glad you said that, because that is actually a little bit of a common misconception, a myth that we sort of propagated, that you spice something to hide maybe off flavors from spoilage. But what's really happening is that something like chili peppers, a major ingredient in chili powder, they are extremely antimicrobial. They kill about 99.9% of bacteria, viruses, and funguses. And so when you add that to a food like chili, a very meat-heavy food, it can prevent spoilage, not hide it.
Okay, now that's a little bit of a hair splitting there, but it's fundamental. Yeah, thank you for straightening me out on that.
And so when you think about spicy food, it tends to come from the hottest parts of the world, whether we're talking about India or whether we're talking about Texas and Mexico, which is where chili and chili powder originated. So it really has preservative qualities.
And conversely, in Norway, you have no need for that. So you just stick your food on the back porch and it stays cool because it's like the world is a refrigerator.
Exactly. That's exactly it. But we also have this human love of spicy foods. When we eat spicy foods, it releases endorphins because it triggers the same receptors in our mouth that trigger when something is physically hot, like our cup of coffee is too hot. That is also being tripped when we have a really hot bowl of chili. So our brain says, we're in trouble. It releases good feeling chemicals. But then when we're okay, it's kind of like riding a roller coaster, like, ooh, maybe I want to do that again.
Man, this is fascinating. Sarah, let's talk about soy sauce, because I guess you can say we have a very diverse population, so soy sauce would make sense. But I think of that obviously more Asian than I think of it as American.
I was shocked to discover that the first soybean farm and soy sauce factory in America was actually established in the 18th century. And so we love soy sauce, which is, oh my gosh, it's a complicated story. Basically, we have soy sauce and fish sauce, which is coming from East Asia. But the same traders that went over there for spices love those sauces. And so really in England, they started creating sauces like them. Worcestershire sauce is a good example. That's sort of a British version of soy sauce. And so then British Americans really still love that salty, savory flavor.
Oh,
and so
Worcestershire is an example of that.
Yes.
But it's not really borrowed from Asia. It is just fundamentally English.
It's, well, the concept is Asian. So, you know, if we're talking fish sauce or soy sauce, the British didn't have those ingredients to make that same thing. So they started playing with other fermentables, other local varieties of fish to create something similar. We did that here. Actually, ketchup is sort of a descendant of soy sauce, because it was Americans trying to replicate soy and fish sauce with tomatoes. And then Heinz sort of added a little more sugar and vinegar.
Yeah.
And that's how we got modern ketchup. So all these sauces are related. It just took a little while for soy to get here. And then, of course, as Asian populations increased in the mid-19th century through the late 20th century, then we see more. Now we have both, not just soy sauce, but fish sauce and shrimp sauce and all those really savory sauces.
We're tasting our way through the history of American cuisine right now on Travel with Rick Steves with Sarah Lohman. She's a culinary historian and an author who helps create public programs focused on food. Sarah's written the book 8 Flavors to look at the stories behind American cuisine. Her latest book is called Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. You can find links to Sarah's work with the show notes for this episode at ricksteves.com/radio. So we're just scratching the surface of the chapters. And one of my favorite chapters is also one of my favorite flavors, tastes, garlic. What would we be without garlic?
Yeah. I mean, and what's so crazy about that is, of course, garlic, you know, we see it used medically a lot in early America, but not in cuisine until the massive immigration from Italy and Sicily around the turn of the 20th century. And I should also give credit to the Eastern European Jewish immigrants, too, who also use garlic quite a bit.
Okay, so wait a minute. We used it before we realized it was fun as kind of a medicinal thing.
Yeah.
And then with the help of Italians, we realized, hey, garlic, let's celebrate it.
Yeah, and a little bit, honestly, World War One and Two, because it's a big part of the cuisine of the south of France. Because early on, people didn't want to emulate Italian and Jewish immigrants. In fact, garlic became very much stereotyped as stinky and gross and associated with that idea of those new Americans who weren't very American yet. So it took us wanting to emulate French food for us to really start eating a lot of garlic. And then just time. By the 70s, you get like Gilroy's Garlic Festival coming together. So now we're talking about the grandchildren of those original turn of the century immigrants. And so you can sort of come out as a garlic lover and it's more acceptable.
Can you imagine bullheaded, simple-minded, fear-based racism keeping you away from something as beautiful as garlic?
I mean, of course I can, because unfortunately Americans still do it today. You know, one of the sort of greatest traumas, or it's a more complicated thing, of the children of immigrants is if they bring in a lunchbox full of the foods that they love that their mom is making. You know, there's this fear of the other, their classmates going, ew, what is that? You know, we still yuck other people's yum. And a lot of times it's more about things being quote unquote foreign than things not tasting good. It's different. It didn't matter whether an individual kid liked it or not. There was this idea of like, well, this is not American.
Yeah,
it's different.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I hope that we're discarding a lot of those ideas because they're pretty silly and they just get into the
silly
way of us enjoying new foods and cultures.
Well, we have not had much problem with sriracha.
No, I mean, it's truly an American story. I think a lot of people think that it is a sauce from Thailand or Vietnam. It is not. It was created by a refugee family from Vietnam. The creator's named David Tran. He and his family ended up in Boston in the early 1980s. His brother was in L.A. He called his brother and said, do they have hot peppers there? His brother said, yes. Picked the family up, started making sriracha from ripe jalapeno peppers in 1982. They have never spent a dollar on advertising, and they have sold out all their bottles of sriracha every year. Usually they're sold out even before they're made.
Amazing. And what a success story. And that's sort of like the rough and tumble, beautiful thing about the free market.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's good, if it's there, it's going to prosper. I was fascinated, Sarah, to see MSG, monosodium glutamate, on the list. Tell us about that, because it gets kind of a bad rap.
It does. And, you know, I really wanted to dive into it to combat that prejudice, because certainly we associate it, I think, largely with Chinese food and that it's bad for you. And that's sort of like, again, that food-based racism, that has connections back to the 19th century when Chinese immigrants were stereotyped as chopping up rats and cats in their food. And that's just the modern sort of version of it. It's silly, right? But at the same time that we were targeting, you know, a poor family-run Chinese food restaurant, MSG was being used by the tens of thousands of tons in American processed food and fast food brands, and still is. There is no proof. It's one of the most studied ingredients in American food that it is bad for you at all. But like anything, salt, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, you have to use it in moderation, right? That's the bottom line. So it adds a delicious, savory taste to foods. And again, we've seen an increased immigration since 1965 from Southeast Asia and Asia. And so now we're seeing it as more of an accepted and common ingredient. For a lot of East Asian families, MSG sits on the table with salt and pepper.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's got a marketing problem just based on its name. They should think of some kind of curry powder. That's a nice name. Soy sauce, sriracha.
Well, there's
MSG.
Accent. There are brand names. There's Accent. There's Kitchen Bouquet. I assume probably has it,
Kitchen
too.
Kitchen Bouquet. Okay,
right?
There you go.
So you just got to think of, like, better marketing. But, of course, Ajinomoto is the biggest brand internationally that produces MSG. They were actually the first Japanese manufacturing plant in America before cars or computers. Ajinomoto landed in the upper Midwest.
Sarah Lohman offers a culinary history of America in her book, Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. She's also written Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. She offers recipes with her newsletter at sarahlohman.com. Sarah, you wrote that you've got great pride in American food. And I'm wondering, that's a beautiful thing, to have pride in our food. Why, and where do you think we're heading as a cuisine?
I mean, especially because I think American food is much maligned as all hot dogs and hamburgers, both by people from outside this country and even Americans. We don't recognize the incredible cuisine we have here. And I think when it comes to American food, diversity is our strength. When it comes to America, like, that is what makes us so special. We can travel the world when it comes to food and culture without ever leaving the boundaries of our country. Although you should, too, and get out there and see the world. But, like, I love that we are so different, and that makes us such a wonderful place to be.
So to embrace the diversity that we are as a country, and that includes the food as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your work with Eight Flavors, the untold story of American cuisine. Best wishes, Sarah.
Thank you, Rick.
Oh, mersey dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kiddly divey too, wouldn't you? A kiddly divey too, wouldn't you?
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. You can find links to our guests and listen to a podcast version of the show or search the archives. It's all at ricksteves.com/radio.
Rick Steves Classroom Europe is a fast, free, and fun video archive. It's designed for teachers, travelers, and students. It gives you immediate access to some 500 short video clips from the Rick Steves Europe TV show library. Clips cover European history, art, culture, food, and geography. Google Classroom Europe or visit ricksteves.com to watch clips and create your own playlist. Teachers love it. Students do, too.